Hello and welcome to Epochs number 114. I'm joined by a returning guest, Rupert August. Rupert, how are you?
Doing very well. Thanks for having me on again. Sorry, yeah. It's been so long.
Yeah, no, not a problem. Happy to have you on. Last time we talked about the Stuart Restoration, that is the English monarchs coming back after Oliver Cromwell's interregnum. This time we're going to talk about the Bourbon Restoration, which is the French monarchs coming back after that little episode of Napoleon Bonaparte.
Yeah, the great kerfuffle.
The great Gallic kerfuffle. So first thing I wanted to ask you then, because I'll sort of let you take the reins on this one. You're much more of an expert on it. I must admit, there's, you know, no one can know all of history inside out. And the Bourbon Restoration, although I know the main players and the main events and things, I don't know it in fantastic detail. So I am looking to learn a few things here today myself. I wondered, though, how far you wanted to take it. I guess we're going to talk about Louis the 18th. Did you want to go into also Charles the 10th? And, you know, beyond that, how far did you want to go with it?
We'll definitely touch on the monarchs themselves, but there's a particular interest that I have in this period, which is the dynamic of a group called the Knights of the Faith, which I think are chronically understudied, but are definitely quite interesting to sort of understanding this whole period. And I think there's sort of certain lessons to sort of draw out of that for any groups who might consider themselves to be in a similar predicament. And they're kind of like one of the main driving forces that I see that is keeping the Bourbon Restoration on the sort of straight and narrow, as it were, and their eventual destruction and disbanding really basically presages the undermining of the Bourbon Restoration as a whole. So they're who I'm going to mainly want to be focusing on.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. Well, I'll let you go then. I suppose the obvious place to start perhaps is the fall of Bonaparte, at least the first time, because Louis the 18th, the king, the returning Bourbon king, sort of has two bites of the cherry, so to speak, doesn't he? He comes back, but then Napoleon has his famous 100 days, his sort of return from Elba and a swan song of 100 yes. days for Napoleon, and which after that, Louis the 18th comes back again, i.e. for the second time. So I'll let you pick it up wherever you think is best or however you think's best.
Well, I think it's probably sensible to start a little bit earlier than that because, okay, sure. Again, this group, the probably butchering the French, but the Chevalier de la Foi, they actually start off a little bit earlier than that. The man who founded them himself, one Ferdinand de Berthier de Sauvigny, he was actually the son of an attendant, quite close personal attendant, I believe, to Louis XVI, who was murdered during the earlier stages of the revolution in 1789. And I imagine that left quite the imprint, as it did on many of the figures. So one thing that's quite interesting that you see about the reaction to the French, like the counter-revolutionary attempts, is a lot of the people actually have some kind of like personal relationship to either Louis XVI or the starting out events. So some of the famous figures especially the noblemen in the Vendée, the famous war in the Vendée, a lot of those guys had actually originally fought to defend, the palaces and defend the royal person and, taken part in the attempt to defend against the mob. And so when they are sent home, then their personal connection to the king doesn't waver, and they just see what sort of, from the revolutionary perspective, what trouble they can cause out on the peripheries. There's another thing that's worth covering beforehand, though, that's quite interesting to get a sort of like a fuller picture of what the right was doing during this period. And I only sort of discovered this recently, but the original movements that were actually meant to be bolstering the support of the king were much more in traditionally monarchist areas. Because funnily enough, the Vendée was not known as somewhere that was particularly loyal to the king and the French central project, because I think it had been one of the main strongholds of Protestantism and sort of like the Huguenot movement during the French Wars of Religion. So the place where a lot of this was supposed to be set up and where it initially was set up was actually down in the southeast, around sort of Provence and the sort of Rhône area, up as far as Lyon. And Lyon did become an important center of the counter revolution later. But even before that, at the very outset, when you get all of the noble emigres who are sort of like leaving in the first wave, quite a lot of them do go on to the kingdom of Piedmont, Sardinia. Mm. And they are based out of Turin to try and, reestablish the king's power. And I believe they're even headed by the future Charles X, even at that time, who I believed it was one of the early ones that went into exile as the Count of Artois, I believe. Mm-hmm. He was still at the time. So that movement was initially set up, and they were trying to network with people on the ground, try and build up a local base of support that would actually rise up and then declare a kind of regional secession to try to essentially reconquer France. But because the events of, the events in Paris sort of got away from a lot of the people, got away from the king in particular. He was actually forced into a position where he had his loyalists out on the peripheries advocating against his own policies, because his own policies were being sort of forced through at the point of a bayonet.
And when you speak of the king at this point, you're talking about Louis the 16th, right?
This is still Louis the 16th, okay. But when he's being essentially held hostage by the revolutionaries.
Okay.
And so this was what was initially meant to be the main thrust of like the actual proper sponsored royalist movement in France, but it splinters on the ground. It also splinters due to divisions that are still extant between Huguenot groups like Protestants and Catholics, and so a lot of the local rivalries on the ground end up fizzling up. But even more than that, the king himself is eventually forced to basically demand that they stand down. So a lot of them do on the basis of that. And then further than that, because some of them are still so dedicated to his cause that they're willing to sort of go against his own word in order to try and see his prerogatives and mandates upheld. They continue to try to organize, but he basically demands that the government in Turin crack down on them and interrupt what they're doing. And so they are forced to relocate. And that's kind of when you see the second movement of the emigres, and they sort of get splintered off even more. A lot of them lose heart at that point, and they end up just sort of going and taking part in other things, and just sort of treat their exile as a little bit more permanent. But that's when you get the emigre army up with up in Germany, sort of more being formed. But that's caught off guard later on. But sorry, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say, it is an interesting thing to note, isn't it, in the grander sweep of the story of the French Revolution, that sometimes people think, a mob rose up in Paris and perhaps marched on Versailles, and that was sort of it. The government fell. There weren't sort of, the royalists didn't put up a fight, but of course it was quite a bitter fight all over the place. And a lot of them fled into exile, as you mentioned, into sort of Piedmont and places, all sorts of places. And a lot of them, I think it often is the case, isn't it, with sort of reactionary politics, that isn't really the right term, but I think what you're about to start explaining, the story of ultra royalists, right? A faction of politics which is more royalists than the actual monarch themselves, in a way.
This comes back in a very big way in the form of Louis XVIII, but we'll sort of get to that soon.
Sure.
The other funny thing is that though, at various points, so the royalist movement sort of goes in a lot of different directions at this time. And I think it's part of this this sort of general tendency and this experience that sort of shapes the later royalist disposition, because you do get schisms later on as to how it should be handled at a tactical or even a strategic level. How should you be trying to get behind the idea of royalism potentially in the face of the king? And I think this is a very informative experience. This sort of like earlier stage down in Piedmont.
It's interesting, isn't it? And I know that you mentioned Leon there. Just one thing I would say I've always find fairly interesting is that a lot of the revolutionaries, the revolutionary governments in Paris did have to send out sort of small armies to butcher lots of royalists, lots of towns that were effectively declared themselves to be royalist. I think in Lyon, the revolutionaries had to kill lots and lots and lots of people in Lyon, herd them into barns and set the barns alight and all sorts of frightfulness like that. So it's not like the royalist feeling in France just sort of disappeared? It didn't, did it? Not at all.
No, I mean, it you can go as far as to say that it was the dominating feeling for practically the entire period up to, I mean, you could potentially go as far as the 1870s or 80s, and that royalism is still the sort of dominant sentiment, but it just never quite has the same, they're basically a bunch of roadblocks in the way, or bumps in the road that end up derailing it to the extent that it can never reassert itself properly. But they face the problem early on, especially of organization. Because what do you do if you're a revolutionary group that is not at all used to being a revolutionary group? You don't have any of the skills built up for doing things like evading police, especially secret police, capture and disruption. You're used to being in charge, and you're used to trying to maintain authority and order rather than trying to, subvert it, essentially.
That's a good point. One last thing I'd just like to note on that. I think it's a very good point you've made, that it lasted past the 1848 great year of revolution, because Napoleon III was, voted president, but then sort of quite quickly just declared himself emperor and, ruled for ages, 17 odd years, something like that. So just a point is, again, a very broad point, I think, is that even though we've got this idea that the French are sort of staunch anti-monarchists, it died hard, didn't it? It died quite hard in the French heart. They were prepared to, they weren't prepared to give up their monarchy all that easily. I think that's an understatement.
Yeah, well, the third French Republic was actually founded, so after the Franco-Prussian War, it was founded by monarchists incredibly reluctantly.
Right. Yeah, another great point. Sorry, I'll let you carry on with the last days of Louis XVI.
Well, this experience is quite informative, I would say, to later history. And where I would pick this thread back up is over in 1807. So you have some figures like de Savigny serving alongside the émigrés and still sort of keeping up the banner, even though they've been, essentially chased across Europe at various points. So you get some of the, I believe it was the victory at Valmy, which sort of like crushed the original impetus to reimpose the monarchy by force. And that's when the revolutionary spirit kind of becomes a lot more martial, and it gets a fire lit under it, which, keeps burning for quite a long time and all across Europe, obviously. But figures like de Savigny in particular, try to think about how they can better usurp, better basically do to the new revolutionary government by this point under Napoleon what the revolutionaries had done to them. And so one thing that it's treated as a bit ridiculous now, just sort of like an obsession that had no real basis in truth, but there was a widespread belief among the émigrés that essentially it was all just down to Masons, and that there was just sort of like a cadre of groups like Freemasons and some others, possibly Jesuits. I can't remember whether they were supposed to have been involved or not. I don't think so, but yeah, the Masons were the big one, basically, and it was essentially just a conspiracy from inside, more or less.
What was the revolution or the revolution or the Napoleonic itself, era?
Well, yeah, I mean both right, in a way, but primarily
it doesn't make
the revolution.
Sense, like you say. Yeah.
And then essentially, from this conclusion, the Savigny and his brother, and I think a few others, basically set out to try to, accepting that as the case, how do we reverse the revolution? Well, we do it by recreating the Masons, but for our purposes. So what they do is that they, in the name of Christendom in particular, because this is after Napoleon is excommunicated, and a lot of the the Catholic and Royal Army is the main Vendée army. So Catholicism is one of the main impetuses here, but alongside restoring things back to their sort of their proper place in 1789, they decide that they're going to form a Masonic type group with that express purpose in mind, basically, like an anti-masonry.
Okay.
So what they do initially is they actually infiltrate the Masons itself. They figure out the structure. They work out how it all works at a sort of like institutional level, and then they straightforwardly just copy it. They just recreate their own group called the Chevalier de la Foi that I mentioned, the Knights of the Faith, and they use it as they use it as a vector basically to try to, for one thing, network up all of the different pro-royalist forces, especially in terms of the aristocrats. So they're trying to particularly select for people with, you know, some means and some influence, and then gather all those people together into a single organization that can be guided into, you know, in the direction of the restoration of the Bourbons. And this takes place over the course of, I think it's supposed to have been officially founded, it's something like 1810. And then it continues through to 1826, essentially, but we'll sort of get back to that. But in its sort of like more revolutionary form, it obviously continues through to about 1815, 1816, when the Bourbon Restoration starts in earnest.
There's one thing I wanted to ask there. You mentioned that sort of starting in about 1807 or 1810, something like that. In that period, that's when Napoleon arguably is sort of towards the very top of his career, you know, sort of the great year of 1805, he's had that, but the disasters of Russia in 1812 hasn't happened, and Spain hasn't gone completely awry yet. Well, it's in about 1810, isn't it? It starts to go terribly wrong in Spain. So between 1807, 1810, I can only imagine this group and all the emigres and the exiled Bourbons, they sort of must be at their, psychologically, I suppose, at their lowest ebb. I mean, aren't a lot of them, isn't the later Louis XVIII and his brother, the Comte d'Artois, aren't they a lot of them in America? Either way, though, it just looks like that Bonaparte is riding high, is kind of invincible on some level. He's not going anywhere soon.
Yes, this actually influences their strategy quite significantly. Because one other thing that's quite vital is that I believe by this point the uprisings in the Vendée have basically calmed down. They've been more or less subdued. And although that is not completely the case, there are still a lot of those sort of simmering resentments. The sort of worst of it when it was threatening to overtake whole regions of France is sort of somewhat past. And so anybody who is kind of looking at a potential Bourbon restoration has to take a different kind of vector. And so the way that they do this is through, again, basically just sort of networking everyone up, getting everyone communicating, getting everyone on the same page, organizing a structure of communication, organization, direction, quite importantly, and making sure that they have some kind of like coherent organization that they can govern somewhat nationwide. And that's basically what they focus on at the start. As you were saying, Napoleon is riding high for quite a long time. And what that means is that for its early stages, the knights basically just develop the organization and get everyone talking, and not really that much else. All they really want to do at that point is to try and build a kind of grassroots support to not only get everyone connected up, but also to try to, you know, proselytize royalism at a very low level. And that's one of the interesting things about the Knights, actually, is that at the very lowest level, and this is much like how the Masons are supposed to operate, at the very lowest level, you would not actually know that you're involved in a revolutionary organization. You were basically just taking part in a Catholic charity group, which has some elements of nostalgia for the sort of like, for the royalist era that's now passed. But that's all it was. If you demonstrated either, you know, competence or interest, then you would be brought in gradually into higher and higher levels where you kind of get more of an understanding about what the group is actually doing. But it's not until you get into the potentially even the highest levels of leadership that you have any idea that the actual goal of the organization itself is the overthrow of the Napoleonic government and the revolutionary government, and to try to revert things back to 1789.
I feel like there's some parallels there in some perverse way with the Church of Scientology. But another thing you talked about where their first goal, or among their first goals, was just to get people talking, get lines of communications between people. Do you know what sprung to mind was the committees of correspondence in the American Revolution? that first and foremost, we just needed these disparate states, these disparate and often physically far flung from each other groups of people to sort of be on one page and to start communicating with each other. Sort of, that's the first step.
It is, yeah. And it has a very powerful effect, actually, even if it's even if it's not immediately something which is going to be transferred into power. What it means is that it basically creates other opportunities down the line. And that's one of the things that they kind of struggle with, in a sense, is because the turnaround for Napoleon happens so quickly that no one on the ground, in terms of the knights, among the ranks of the knights, are actually capable of responding to it in a timely enough fashion. So their persistent goal never really changes, like right up until the point at which Allied troops are marching into France. So they're still on the same page of just, you know, getting the word out and trying to get everyone networked in together. Again, primarily aristocrats, but, you know, bearing in mind there's, you know, a million or more aristocrats. So this isn't a small group by any stretch.
Yeah. When you say they're the turnaround for Napoleon, do you mean his downfall?
Yes. Right. His initial, so yeah. not the 100 days, but, you know, is the reversal of fortunes of Napoleon is not something that the knights are ultimately prepared for.
Right.
So what it means is that they're not prepared to launch any kind of insurrection or uprising, because it had never been sort of built into their intended strategy at that stage. They were thinking, maybe, as far as I can tell, they were thinking that maybe that would be a possibility somewhere down the line, but they did not think that they were anywhere near ready for that, nor did they think that it would be something that they would be prepared for in a short time span. So basically, they're forced to accept the fact that France is going to be invaded by liberated by the Allied powers, and they are going to have a relatively minimal role in it, but they sort of scramble to do what they can. So in particular, whenever there are any armies that are coming and taking French towns, so in particular Bordeaux, taken by Wellington, the people that come out and meet the troops are essentially Knights of the Faith or mobs that have been organized by the Knights of the Faith wearing uniforms. Basically, they have white cockades, and they're all basically, you know, on the same page, and they're all chanting for the return of the Bourbons. And so in that sense, they can present the image of a fait accompli, and they can actually negotiate. The local department leaders, the regional leaders of the Knights of the Faith, can be the ones who are actually negotiating with the Allied armies and presenting themselves as the new governments of these various towns and cities.
Right. So just for people just who might not know, Wellington essentially wins the Peninsular War, boots all the French marshals out of Spain, crosses the Pyrenees, and of course then you're just immediately in France. You're invading Bonaparte's homeland sort of immediately. But also the Russians and the Prussians are closing in much further north from the east into northern France up there, sort of at the same time, really.
Yeah.
Isn't it? It's pretty much exactly the same time. Like Napoleon reaps the whirlwind all at once there in 1814, isn't it?
Yeah, they make an attempt to sort of hold things off in the east and the northeast, but ultimately they're beat back, and Napoleon is forced into abdicating unconditionally, more or less, by his marshals.
I have heard, actually, just a quick side note. I've heard that Napoleon, despite having quite green troops under him at that point, performed some of among his greatest feats in that sort of grand retreat there in 1814. But nonetheless, it was an impossible task, really. He could never have, almost certainly never have actually, become victorious that year. When he's first overthrown, I wanted to ask you, actually, because Louis the 18th comes back, the younger brother of the guillotined Louis the 16th.
Yeah.
How much of a shoe-in was he? You know, how was it just a no-brainer to everyone, Frenchman at the time, or was there a lot of debate about it, or did he just get in with by the skin of his teeth? Because the impression I've got, the fairly relatively low resolution impression, is that it was a little bit of a no-brainer to a lot of the people in power, because I think the British and probably the Prussian and Russian and Austrian statesmen, it was up to them, essentially, wasn't it, what was going to happen next? Correct me if I'm wrong.
Not quite. So the interesting thing is that, and I was just about to get to this, so it sort of works well in a way, because when the writing is on the wall, the turncoat extraordinaire Talleyrand basically flips sides and presents himself. He gathers up another a load of bureaucrats and ministers and everything who are sort of willing to switch sides and join represent France basically as a provisional government. So they form their own government that is quite apart from all of the structures that have been developed by the actual royalists themselves. And they present themselves as the provisional government, which is going to be the one that is negotiating with the Allied powers. And that's something that the Allies much, much prefer for a couple of reasons, not least the fact that they don't want, they don't actually like the Knights of the Faith. They don't like the Bourbons fundamentally because, you know, for historic reasons, there are, you know, basically none of these powers are on particularly good terms with the Bourbons from a historic, you know, from a historic perspective. They'd always been the enemy. And so that's partly why in the early stages of the revolution, basically everybody's quite happy to see the revolution as the good comeuppance, the just comeuppance for the Bourbons who had been acting so badly. And they were just sort of happy to see their enemy getting knocked down a peg. But it also means that when you get groups coming along who are, you know, fervently pro that establishment, they're not actually too keen on the idea of working with them. So they would rather work with Talleyrand, who is much more of a, well, from their perspective, moderate figure. You know, some might say pragmatic, but some might say something else. But essentially, these are the figures who are actually doing the diplomatic wrangling at the national level, and so they are basically handed the opportunity to form the new government how they wish, and the knights are actually left out in the cold again, basically, because although they have some kind of some regional influence that they've been able to develop, they're the de facto governors essentially of various sections like Bordeaux, where they've risen up and basically been the figures to actually negotiate on the ground with various commanders, and sometimes I believe even open the gates to the armies, rather than, you know, forcing them to be besieged or whatever. Mm. And so the government that's actually formed is under Talleyrand instead, and Talleyrand, by his own like proclivities, would rather have someone that's a little bit more of a liberal figure. A much more moderate royalist who possibly even accepts some of the ideas of the revolution, such as a Louis the Eighteenth. But not only that, but many of the figures in the Allies would actually rather that as well. Mm. So they just sort of, you know, negotiate amongst themselves. And so whether there really was any kind of question of some other figure other than Louis the Eighteenth ascending, I'm not entirely sure, because my sense is that it would sort of undermine the monarchy itself if you were to just arbitrarily choose somebody who is not next in the line of succession, basically,
or not necessarily have a monarchy at all. I mean, who knows? I guess it really was all up in the air at that point. I can only imagine. Quick note to say, just about Talleyrand, if people don't know about him or anything, I really dislike Talleyrand, obviously, but I really like to dislike him. Do you know what I mean? He's one of those people in history who is sort of, well, in my opinion, anyway, sort of thoroughly dislikable, but in sort of quite a charming, charismatic way, and he's sort of such a survivor. He was around during the revolution, all the way through the Napoleonic era, you know, right at the heart of government, absolutely at the heart of things. And then even at this point, he becomes he's able to just switch sides again, and people sort of somehow accept him. He's sort of extremely clever and slippery and slimy, but you know, not out and out. You know, he's not evil. I don't think. I mean, he's quite corrupt, quite venal, perhaps, but not. You know, he's not a monster. Anyway, I don't know how you feel about Talleyrand, but just a quick note on him that, you know, what a pivotal figure, absolutely pivotal figure for France in this period. I just quite like to dislike him. What's your feeling about him?
He's a worm. He's a bit of a snake. but he's like you said, he's quite fun historical character. Yeah. So I think he's one of the cases where if you put almost anyone else in his position, then you get very different outcomes in history.
Right. Yeah.
Because one thing that France does have to thank him for is the fact that he was able to force his way in personally, not necessarily on behalf of France, but on his own sort of personal merits into the Congress of Vienna. So he is actually able to be there as a voice in favor of France when all of the negotiations about what is going to happen to France are happening. So, you know, you can only imagine what would happen, what would be the case later in, say, World War One, if you'd had, you know, like a more active German, Austro-Hungarian, or you know, Ottoman representative who was actually able to argue their case, potentially even just on their own personal merits. And that's basically what Talleyrand represents for France.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.